Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Michael Bacchiatlis. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Adam, again.
Well, let's first talk about our guest today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Casey Humbird about a unique challenge physicians face in the age of social media. Dr. Humbird is an orthopedic surgeon and medical ethicist at Johns Hopkins University. I'm looking forward to that conversation. I think it raises all kinds of questions that happen to me, and I expect it happens to a lot of colleagues around the country.
Yeah, especially those who are have an active presence on social media.
First off, we have some research we want to talk about. Let's talk about the very first one, which has to do with asparagus and cancer. First off, do you like asparagus?
I don't know. I think it depends on the day and the dish.
Yeah, I like asparagus, but in moderation. In this particular research, they are really interested in asparagus is one of the foods that has high levels of asparagine, an amino acid that some researchers think is involved in spreading of cancer.
Yes, and this article came out of the journal Nature. And what they were able to show is that reminder that this is in lab mice, okay, not human beings, they were able to show that these aspergine-rich foods, including dairy, beef, poultry, eggs, nuts, seeds, the list goes on and on, that cancer was more spread in those mice with these different types of food, which I think gets into a larger issue of epigenetics, which what we put into our bodies and what we experience in the environment may actually control and have effects on our health and our genetic DNA.
Now, before people run out and say what is good for mice is good for humans or bad for mice, bad for humans, we should really take a pause and say this study did not show that a low asparagine diet can reduce asparagine levels in healthy patients. And we don't know if this actually would have any impact whatsoever on human cancers. And a lot of the foods in here are a lot of the foods that people recommend. They're the whole grains, pretty natural foods for healthy diet and healthy living. So I don't think we should, I wouldn't want people to say, oh, I need to start limiting myself in diet, because the research on diet and human cancers right now is still in flux. There's very little for certain.
I'll be continuing to prescribe asparagus as needed.
Speaking about as needed, this is our very next research that matters. It's about self-defeating humor and psychological well-being. And what do we talk about when we talk about self-defeating humor?
Well, let's just define that for our listeners. So self-defeating humor is aimed at gaining the approval of others through self-mockery. And in this particular study, which was in the International Journal for Personality and Individual Differences, they showed that this form of humor exhibited greater levels of psychological well-being. It's key to remember that the adaptive styles of humor, particularly that there are many different types of humor out there, including self-defeating humor, allow potentially a more relaxed outlook on life and help deal with more adverse or stressful situations.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated because they talk about affiliative humor. It's strengthening social relationships, social enhancing humor to maintain a humorous outlook in potentially stressful circumstances, which I'm like, you know, you're sitting there in traffic and you're not moving and you got to be somewhere in 30 minutes and you say, it's going to be an hour and a half. What are you going to do right then? It's like, oh, you could either cuss or you could say, we got some time on our hands here.
And just of note here, this was done in a Spanish population. And I think it's important to remember that new studies, you know, this is one isolated study, you need to really take into account cultural differences in the different types of humor that are used. It may be more acceptable or less acceptable in different parts of the world.
And we don't want humor to hide any negative things. So if the humor is really designed to hide a negative intention, you know, I'm feeling some anger right now. You know, you might say it in a certain way, but it's like, oh, well, you're really angry right now. So we have to be really careful of how it's being used. But to know that humor is just a wonderful tool sometimes to relieve stress.
I give you permission to continue making self-deprecating comments about yourself.
Well,
it may help your wellness.
But not you.
But not me.
Well, let's talk about our very next research that matters. And this is really quite serious research. And this is about couples that are in relationships, particularly among younger couples, and decisions they make about contraception.
So this was published recently in the Journal of Sex Research. This came out of Oregon State University. And what this study looked at, Adam, was the dynamic qualities of specific relationships and how relationships can significantly predict contraceptive use.
Now, they looked at, over a period of time, young adults, 1,280 interviews with 470 young adults, and they were looking at, in particular, their sexual activity, their use of contraception, the type of relationship they had and how long they've been in the relationship, were they with one partner, how often they had sexual relations, and then the commitment they had, all of which to try to find out is the more they were having a deeper, stronger relationship, it appeared a little bit less likely that they would be using what we might call optimal safe sex practices.
I think this really gets back to looking at high-risk sexual behavior versus maybe less high-risk sexual behavior. Now, remember that 50% of pregnancies are unintended, and so looking at some of this data here, 41% of participants used only condoms, nearly 25% used a hormonal or long-acting form, and 13% reported using dual methods.
Yeah, they were looking at the vulnerability to pregnancy and the perceived vulnerability to sexually transmitted infections. And certainly, they might have continued, let's say, to use one form of birth control to prevent the pregnancy, but it wouldn't give them protection against the sexually transmitted infections. Perhaps they felt less that they were at risk for these. So I think this is interesting. I think it's an important one. And I think when we have young adults in our offices, I think perhaps you, I, our colleagues, maybe should ask a little bit deeper question and not make some assumptions that just because they were doing one practice for prevention of infections and sexually transmitted illnesses, it doesn't mean that it would have continued 6 months into the relationship.
Absolutely. And looking at the status of a relationship and the health of a relationship as well, and not forgetting about our other screening practices that we do for sexually transmitted diseases, but also, you know, safety in the home as well.
Let's talk about our last research that matters, Michael. And this is about acne and depression. Did you ever have acne as a kid?
Oh, let's not bring that up.
Oh, no. We're back to the self-deprecating humor.
We're back to it there. Yes, I did have acne as a teenager and was actually put on by a dermatologist for Accutane with some pretty astonishing results.
But, because that's for pretty severe acne. So you would understand this research more than others who maybe have never had acne, which is depression more common in people who have acne?
Yeah, and let's looked at a study from the British Journal of Dermatology. They looked at a database of over 130,000 men and women and followed them for 15 years. And over the study period, the probability of developing major depression was 18.5% among patients with acne and 12% in those without. Pretty astonishing.
Yeah, and they said the risk was highest in the first year, in which 63% of those had an increased risk of depression if they had acne. After 5 years, it seems like whatever that risk kind of went away. Maybe because the acne got treated, maybe because it wasn't as much of an issue. And we know that things like depression actually can make acne worse. And we know that depression is causally related to onset of acne because of perhaps being ridiculed, social issues, perceptions, lots of things.
And typically with our patients who we are treating in the outpatient setting in primary care, usually for some of the interventions like the topical antibiotics or oral antibiotics, we're usually seeing these kind of young adolescents or young adults every 3 months. And so it may be worthwhile in that initial treatment period that we're screening for or at least addressing this issue.
Yeah, and I also think that when we see acne, it's not simply enough to say, does the acne bother you? Because sometimes the kids will say, well, no, it doesn't. But we then know from this data that there's a lot more going on. We have to probe a little bit deeper.
Lies much deeper.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Michael and I are going to be talking with orthopedic surgeon and medical ethicist at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Casey Humbard, about a unique challenge physicians face in the age of social media. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bacchialis. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Today on Conversations, Michael, we're talking with orthopedic surgeon and medical ethicist at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Casey Humbird, about a unique challenge physicians face in the age of social media.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Humbird.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, you are a clinician, you do research, and that the intersection is a passion for ethics and how it interrelates to both research and your clinical care. How did you get interested in clinical medicine, orthopedics, and ethics?
Well, my interest in orthopedics started from a very young age because when I was 3 years old, I went with my father on rounds, and he's an orthopedic surgeon. So when people asked me what I like to do, I would tell them I like to go to work and take care of my patients. So I was indoctrinated very early into the medical realm, and that has always been a career passion. I became more interested in the realm of ethics and how it interacts with medicine when I was in college, and I did research on birth weight disparities between African Americans and Caucasians. I was working in Philadelphia at the time, and the social justice implications of our health care, the fact that being a racial minority, being born poor, meant that your health outcomes could be different and your access to health care could be different, was something that I became really passionate about, and I've stayed working in the realm of medical ethics ever since.
You and a co-author, Dr. Kavita Shah Arora, recently wrote an interesting piece for Stat News about whether or not physicians who see something that concerns them medically on social media have a responsibility to say anything. How does your background in orthopedics, ethics, extend into this realm?
So it's interesting. I first heard about this story through a closed group on Facebook called the Physicians Moms Group, because I'm a physician and a mom, and those are your two qualifications to get to be part of this group. And there was a trending story on Chip and Joanna Gaines, who are on HGTV with a television show. I believe it's called Fixer Upper. I have to admit I don't get to watch much television. And it was about an ultrasound she had had done that looked highly suspicious, but it was more about the fact that it appeared she'd been told about this suspicious ultrasound for a concerning abnormality to the baby, that she'd been told about it by TMZ, the gossip website, after somebody had commented on her publicly posted image on Instagram that it looked like the ultrasound didn't show a totally healthy, normal pregnancy. And this was just really interesting, and Dr. Arora and I talked about it. Well, what obligation do you have to say something? If you see something, we're always kind of taught after the terrorist attacks, the slogan, if you see something, say something, but that didn't feel quite right for us when it comes to healthcare information being put on social media.
Yeah, it's really interesting. My wife is a dermatologist, and we've written on dermatology together articles, and we've had this long-running debate. If we're out at the beach, which we are occasionally, even though we're kind of bundled up with our sun protection factor and the umbrellas, but you see someone who has a mole on their back that you think could be a melanoma, do you say something?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kind of a similar sort of thing. And my wife and I came to opposite conclusions for a while, which was I said, you say something. And she said, no, you don't say something. And I one time did say something to a teenager, and she got very angry at me.
Mm-hmm.
And like, who are you? Shouldn't be doing that. And her mother, who kind of overheard the conversation, came up to me and said, thank you so much. I've been worried about that, warning her to go take a look at it. So there's a little bit of redemption there, but it wasn't easy. And I wonder, is it harder in situations like social media
where you can't get that immediate feedback from the person that might let you know you either did a good job or you didn't do a good job.
I do think it's a lot more complex as well, because as I always tell my medical students who are looking to apply to residency, whatever you put online lives there forever. And if you post something publicly to somebody, that's going to be there identifiable with them. It's not an interaction on the beach where someone then walks away if they're annoyed with you and nobody else knows about it. And so that introduces this whole other level of everyone gets to see the conversation that you had, whether or not the person we were talking to, even if your goal is completely altruistic and you want to help someone, their rejection of that help doesn't get to be private anymore.
You know, you mentioned to us that story of the, you know, the ultrasound and the folks on TV. Have you seen kind of the negative consequences of someone either pointing something out and the harms that that potentially can bring?
Well, I think with this one, there's probably a pretty direct harm. I cannot comment about how suspicious this ultrasound is or isn't, and it wouldn't be appropriate to since it's an incomplete study. But if you assume that this was a really concerning ultrasound with a likely fatal abnormality, that this baby may not be able to survive, I just think as a mom, if I were to get news like that from a reporter calling from a gossip website, as opposed to getting to find that out in the privacy of a clinical encounter with my physician, I think that could be tremendously harmful and could really break faith for that patient with the medical system.
Well, what's the obligation from an ethical framework for a physician to be involved? Let's say you don't know someone and they're posting something. Maybe you do know them and they're posting something. Because I could see a situation where someone might say, you know, I have a nerve problem. Let's say it's an orthopedic nerve problem. And here's my MRI. And I've got lots of physician friends. I'd like to know what they think. That stuff actually is probably happening.
Oh, all the time. People used to pick up the phone to call for a phone consult, and now they're messaging you through Facebook, you know, old high school friends of, hey, my kid fell down on a slide. When do I bring him to the ER? When do I do X, Y, or Z? For me, I have responded to questions that have been posted on social media, but when I've done so, I have done it through private messaging apps so that if anything I say were to cause distress, at least it does so privately. The theoretical I've kind of come up with is, oh, thank goodness there's no fracture in this ankle, and someone puts up an ankle x-ray, which does indeed show a fracture. Well, how would I deal with that so that you're not publicly calling out the other physician who may have misread the imaging, but also so that someone gets to find out about their own health in a private manner. So I would personally, and what I've done personally, is communicate with a messaging app that's private. So it's just a conversation between myself and them. I think it's really important within social media that as physicians, we remember that we're still physicians, and that if I tell somebody, this is what I'm concerned about, this is what you should do, it carries a different weight, as it should, than somebody else who's giving a home remedy or this is what I've heard type background. You're an expert in an area, and you have to carry that responsibility very seriously. So when someone asks me for advice, I believe that we're establishing a patient-physician relationship, and I thus have to function within the constraints of that relationship, which includes some level of confidentiality.
We're going to get back to that idea of the, you know, patient-physician relationship involving social media, but we need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with orthopedic surgeon, medical ethicist at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Casey Humbert, about a unique challenge physicians face in the age of social media. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bach-Atlas.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with orthopedic surgeon and medical ethicist at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Casey Humbert, about a unique challenge facing physicians in the age of social media. Briefly before the break, we were discussing the patient-physician relationship and really the responsibility of physicians when they see something on social media. What is their duty to report in what instances and when it may be not appropriate?
And Dr. Humbert, I guess one of the questions we wanted to extend it to is we've been talking about some of the physical things that one might see, an abnormal MRI, an X-ray, maybe a physical abnormality. What about if you are reading about posts that are physically suggestive of violence, physically suggestive psychologically of depression, mental illness? Does it also extend in that direction?
I think that's a really great question without a nice, simple answer. First off, I think the relationship is really important. So if you're a physician taking care of a patient and you happen to be friends with them on Facebook or following them on Instagram and it's your patient and they're posting something about an interest in self-harm, you have some level of obligation as their physician to do something, just as you would if you got that information from a family member calling. I don't think we've completely sorted out how to navigate this new world that we're in, where you can be getting multiple inputs about your patient's mental health from so many different sources. I also think it's really fascinating because people curate their online identity. You know, most people aren't putting, I didn't fold my sheets this morning, I didn't make my bed, and my kids may have had Oreo cookies for breakfast. We like to kind of put our best selves out there, but there's also the cries for help that go out as well. And it's become this very intimate personal space that as physicians, I think we're still figuring out how do we navigate it. My analogy is that when you're in those situations, think of how you'd behave in a public forum, in a public space. And most physicians, if someone is in distress in a public space, hopefully most of us are not walking by that person, but instead we're the ones who are stopping, helping, offering assistance. I don't think we lose that responsibility to try and help others when online, but the degrees of responsibility and what they require is a challenge to know. Because at some point as a physician, you should get certain carve-outs where you're allowed some personal space separate from being a doctor. You know, do I have to comment anytime I see a kid in a car seat that isn't properly strapped? Or, you know, I see a parent with a kid on their lap going down a slide, which is an orthopedic surgeon. That's a big mechanism for breaking tibias. It's called a toddler's fracture. How do you reach out in those to try and keep your friends, family, acquaintances healthy?
You bring up a lot of interesting points of sort of about the changing patient-physician relationship and where those interactions are occurring. You know, I can think of an example with, you know, our new electronic health records where patients have pretty much direct kind of messaging, private messaging access to us. But should physicians really, I mean, be, quote unquote, friends with or following, you know, their patients in these different arenas? It does seem, you know, like you're talking about carving out that time away, you know, talking about a big issue currently with healthcare with about physician wellness. How do we separate some of these things out, particularly as it pertains to social media?
I think on this, the AMA really got it right, where they, in their guidelines on professionalism with social media, they said that if you're going to interact with folks on the internet, you must keep the same appropriate boundaries of the patient-physician relationship in accordance with the same professional ethics guidance as you would in any other context. So for me, I keep my profile on social media private. It is uncomfortable because I have had patients manage to find me and they've asked to be friends.
And I actually just talked to the patients one-on-one and said, you know, I don't think that's where our relationship should be. I'm not comfortable with that. But that's tough. And, you know, you want your patients to like you and feel comfortable with you. But it's not a friend relationship, because there's a reason I can't do surgery on my husband or close friends, because you need some level of neutrality to be a good doctor.
Well, in today's world as well, as one moves into rural, smaller communities, you may be relating to people in so many ways in and out of the practice. And I wonder, can I ask you a question? Is your father still alive, who was the orthopedist?
He is.
And does he
still? He is. He's retiring in 3 weeks.
3 weeks. So let's fast forward and just say how marvelous it was that you were able to watch him, and I'm sure he takes great pride in seeing you and your accomplishments. But what would the conversation be like between the two of you about these issues? Is this something that he would have strong opinions on, or he would say, of course, what we're dealing with today has ethical obligations, because you're interested not just in this issue, but broadly about the ethical interface between patients and providers?
Yeah, I think we definitely have an interesting generational divide on this one, where he is less present on social media than I am, though he has a Facebook account, which in his words is to keep up with the grandchildren. But it wouldn't occur to him that patients would be trying to friend him on there, and he would just not respond to those if they did. Because he has said to me what a challenge we have in our generation of, I don't want to say the loss of stature, but of the increased comfort of patients with their physicians, as everyone goes to Dr. Google and comes in saying, this is what I think I have, this is what I think is going on. And that the social media and the internet age has not only changed our interactions with each other, made everyone feel like they're an instant expert, and that it's happening concurrent with an increased familiarity and an increased ability to look and see everything about your physician before you walk into that office. So it's a very interesting dynamic that he and I have talked about a lot of times, that not only do they want to be your friend on Facebook, but they've also confused their Google search with your medical degree. And it's a fascinating dynamic to have to navigate as a physician, when everyone can say, oh, I've already watched my surgery on YouTube, before they come in for their surgery.
So I imagine he would say pretty quickly, you know, I'd be happy to talk with you if you make an appointment to see me in the office.
In a couple weeks.
Exactly.
But be serious about that, that he really would be happy to do that, but he feels that's the right place.
Well, and one of my things is I take care of a lot of doctors and nurses within the Johns Hopkins system, because we have an internal insurer. And so I'm always stopped in the hallway of, and I don't think this is a new phenomenon. I think this has been going on forever, as we call it, a curbside consult. And if I see someone, I say, well, I can give you general advice, but if you want me to really look into your specific problem, you got to meet the patient. And that's tough, because you don't want people to think that you don't want to take care of them and help them. But if they have a real issue, you owe it to them. I feel like it's a disservice to them as a patient seeking medical help if I don't transfer that relationship to its professional realm, where I can get good imaging, where I take the time, I'm not running between things, where I can take the time to really examine them, understand the issue, and give them the best care. It's not fair to them if they don't get the best care.
We've talked a lot about sort of our physician-provider role, sort of that reactionary role to someone trying to connect with you in these different mediums. But what responsibility is there for patients in this sort of modern age, and specifically healthcare, for either moderating what they're posting, or if, you know, again, like you said, from a physician standpoint of wanting to use a direct or a private message for responding to someone, does there need to be some education as well on the flip side, looking at individuals about how they're interacting with their healthcare and social media together?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting concept. I know that I will teach my daughters when they get to the point that they would have a social media account, because you can imagine that if you post something about having been in a car accident And earlier in the day, there are pictures of you with a beer in your hand. That could not only harm your own health, but really future employment prospects and things that used to be private are not private anymore. I personally would never post healthcare information online that is, you know, something that is private and personal. Throughout my pregnancies, I never put anything about being pregnant online, partly because I'm superstitious, but partly it just felt not the right forum for me. I think that is antiquated amongst a lot of my contemporaries. That's felt to be very old-fashioned. But once it's out there forever. And so I do try and have that conversation with my patients, but I also have everybody taking their x-rays before and after in the office. Everyone's taking a photo of it to put on Facebook of their all their metal hardware in their ankle. So I try and educate them that that lives there forever. You go apply for a job that you're on your feet all day, someone's going to Google and see that, and it can hurt you. It's no longer your private information. You've made it public, and trying to educate patients about that component. However much non-discrimination we're supposed to have, I don't always trust that everyone can follow their better angels on that one.
We've been talking with Dr. Casey Humbird, medical ethicist and orthopedic surgeon at Johns Hopkins University, about her perspectives on how physicians face and patients face this age of social media and healthcare. And I think what strikes us, Dr. Humbird, is how you've thought about this, how you have caution in the winds and yet certainly recognize responsibilities as well. And I think for both of those things, your health, we're fortunate to have had you and appreciate what you're doing to bring this to the American public.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca Atlas. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Michael and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. Michael, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today.
My doctor is considering switching the medicine I take for depression. I've experienced some results, but he thinks I might feel even better on something else. I don't want to lose the relief I've found. What do you think?
I think one of the first things that I would ask, pharmacotherapy or, you know, medications for depression is one form of therapy. There are additional forms of therapy that include counseling or talk therapy, and I would be curious to hear what efforts that patient may be investing in or utilizing in regards to talking with someone outside of the home, outside of the clinic setting on a more regular basis.
Because the outcomes of using talk therapy are just as good as medication. In this particular case, it sounds like the provider is really talking about changing medication here, which has its own sets of complications and questions. Like one of them is, are you having side effects of the medication you're taking? It sounds like maybe you're not, but maybe you've gotten some benefit, but maybe you haven't gotten the full benefit, in which case maybe going up on the current dose of the medicine that you're tolerating well is better than adding a second medication or switching medications for side effects you don't know about.
And that's also important to recognize, too, the length of time that this person has been on the medication for. As Adam, you know, you suggested changing medications after someone's been on it for years can really have some not benign effects, like withdrawal symptoms even, depending on what medication they might be switched to. And I think it would be important to have further discussions with that doctor from the patient's perspective about what medication the provider might switch them to and what benefits they might think that might have for the patient.
And sometimes the antidepressant medications just don't work anymore, and in which case it may make perfect sense to switch it, particularly if you were on an older medicine, particularly if you had some sexual side effects that, you know, you didn't really even talk with your doctor that much about, but your libido was low. Mm-hmm. Some of the newer medicines may be less likely to do that. So I think, you know, there's lots of good questions and sub-questions here. Good luck. Thanks so much for that great question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My teenage daughter wears contacts. I've noticed that she has trouble remembering to switch them out monthly and sometimes wears them to bed. What are the risks of this behavior, and do you have any suggestions for me?
I used to wear contacts, and I used to wear them too bad, and I used to have severe problems and the next day.
I second that.
Yeah, you wore contacts too?
I did, and ended up starting with contacts, and they were every 2 weeks they needed to be changed out, and really that became 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 5 weeks even. Sometimes they got left in at nighttime, and I noticed that I began to experience more dryness in my eyes and even ended up actually having a corneal abrasion at one point a few years ago because of it. And since that time, I have daily contacts that I can use if I'd like to switch out my glasses. But for the most part, I got four eyes now.
And you want to protect the two eyes that are really the key one within that four eyes. I wonder that maybe you should make an appointment with your ophthalmologist and really have a detailed conversation, because if your eyes do dry out, you do risk starving for oxygen, that cornea, and you get these corneal abrasions. And literally, your cornea is raw until it heals up for 24 hours, and that may risk further scarring. In addition to which, just having dry eyes is irritating, and you might risk a higher infection risk just from wearing them overnight, exposure to more bacteria. There's lots of ways of going about that, ranging from taking them out and putting new ones in daily to looking like Michael and I, which could be a lot worse.
Eight eyes here. You know, and the other thing, Adam, too, to keep in mind is there are corrective surgeries that are out there. It may not be most appropriate at this age, but again, those are not without harms either, in the sense that those can actually lead to potentially some increased dryness as well. And so it's important to talk to your eye doctor about really the most appropriate therapies and basing those decisions off of the lifestyle choices that you're going to make.
Thanks so much. And Laura, what's our very last house call?
My husband and I are currently on the hunt for a new home, and we found one in an area we like. It seems very well maintained, but the home report says that it has asbestos siding. How much of a risk is that to our health?
Well, let's just all get together, have a little party. We'll do a little asbestos removal. Invite your friends.
You know, you put on your mask, you put on your gloves, you bring your rake, you bring your, you know, the garden hose.
Put an outside fire, you take it off the wall.
Yeah, you make sure that
you burn it.
The burgers and the hot dogs are very close to the siding.
Well, sure that, like that. I'm not sure that's like up that. To code, guys.
Coach mode.
Coach mode, yeah.
You know, it's ironic, but we bought a house recently that we were going to do an investment house, and we found out that there was asbestos siding in the roof. Now, we didn't actually have to take it away because it was there, but, you know, people don't necessarily want to be in a house that they're renting when they know there's asbestos in the roof and the sides. So I would say have second doubts about whether you actually want to do that house. Now, it costs about $6,000 to kind of get this done, but it's still, you know, that's expensive. And so I would be very cautious about whether, because certainly most people won't want to live in there if they know that there's asbestos there.
Absolutely. And I think there's, you know, local agencies that can probably get involved in this particular case to, exactly as Adam said, quoting, you know, how much is this going to cost? You know, does this have an effect on potential future resale value? You know, all those things are important to keep in mind.
And just for the record, Michael and I's attempt at self-deprecating humor, we do not advocate for asbestos parties and burning. Okay,
just let's put that out there. Let's just end that debate really quickly.
Well, we're going to end House Calls on that note today, and we hope that you have enjoyed your health and that we've been able to address some issues and concerns that are important to your health. If you have any questions, you can send your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. Or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And Michael Bach-Atlas.
And we'll look forward to seeing you next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.